Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello, I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. This is Inside Europe. On today's programme, France beefs up security at the Italian border after identitarian militants highlight a new migrant route.
If 100 young boys and girls of Europe can build a border, why a government can't do this too?
A royal birth in Britain and soon a royal wedding.
The Americans are very keen that they're going to get into the royal family at last. They must be over the moon.
The United States moves back into an airbase it left more than a decade ago. These stories and more coming up on Inside Europe. The French government has sent 100 gendarmes to reinforce France's mountainous border with Italy, where migrants regularly attempt to enter the country illegally. The move follows an extraordinary weekend in the Alps that saw anti-migrant activists construct a fence along an unmanned stretch of mountain frontier and pro-migrant activists escort 30 people into France in defiance of the law. This report from our correspondent John Lawrenson.
Dressed in pale blue ski jackets with the words Defend Europe marked on them, 50 or so members of the far-right movement Génération Identitaire, Generation Identity, knock wooden posts into the snow to hold up a long stretch of fluorescent orange plastic fencing. This is the Col de l'Echelle, 1,700 metres in altitude. Now that France has re-established controls on the coastal road and rail line between Italy and France, more and more of the mainly African migrants blocked in the frontier town of Ventimiglia are trying their luck across the mountains. Two helicopters were used in the operation, which Generation Identity says cost €30,000 and was financed by sympathetic business leaders. Damien Rieu is one of the members of this youth group whose aim, according to its website, is what it calls the reconquest of Europe from mass immigration.
We have tried to block the Col de l'Echelle because it's a way for immigrants who come from Italy and who want to go to France and England, and show that if we want, we can't stop them because the government don't want really to stop them. If 100 young boys and girls of Europe can build a border, why a government can't do this too?
Although there are no permanent border controls at this mountain passage, French security forces arrested here and sent back to Italy 1,900 migrants last year. That was up from 315 the previous year. Damien Rieu says they didn't have contact with any migrants, as fellow militants in Italy had warned them not to come as the frontier was blocked. I asked him if he had any sympathy for the migrants.
Yeah, of course. I think they are victims. They are victims of lie because NGO and people who want immigration for destroy Europe use them. But so much migrants, maybe all, are just economic migrants. There is not people who want to escape the war. This is really wrong because we have just 1 or 2% of Syrian and Iraqian who come to France.
The day after Generation Identity's spectacular intervention in the Alps, the pro-migrant group Tous Migrants, We're All Migrants, counter-attacked. Some 100 militants of various European nationalities set off on foot from Italy to France, escorting 30 migrants. The militants clashed at one point with the French security forces, but the latter did not prevent them from entering France, but escorted them to the migrant welcome office in the French city of Briançon. Tous Migrants declined our offer of an interview, but one of its members, Benoît Ducot, told the news website Reporter that this was their response to Generation Identity, to defend, as he put it, fundamental rights, including the right of asylum in the country of your choice. In Paris, Interior Minister Gérard Collomb, currently piloting a new immigration law through Parliament, criticised both what he called the ultra-right and the ultra-left. Well, the National Front, which has been at pains to distance itself from Generation Identity in the past, voiced qualified approval of the mountain border operation through its vice president, Louis Alliot, who had this to say on the news channel BFM TV.
C'est un coup de com' réussi, parce qu'il n'a rien repoussé du tout.
It was a successful communication coup. They didn't stop any migrants because they didn't meet any on that mountain, apparently. But they succeeded in getting the government to understand that there is a border, that it needs controlling, and that we can't leave our borders uncontrolled. The proof is that very evening, the interior minister sent extra gendarmes to reinforce the frontier. So they succeeded in changing the terms of the discussion.
This reinforcement of the mountain frontier follows the ramping up of the protection of the frontier on the Italy-France coastal route over the past couple of years. In 2017, French security forces, who number 600 in and around the border town of Menton, turned back 50,000 people. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
This is Inside Europe. In Britain, over the past week, there's been a mini-boom in newspaper and magazine sales. That's magazines and newspapers carrying pictures of the latest addition to the royal family, the newborn baby son of Prince William and Kate. A royal birth is always good for business. But an even bigger royal bonanza is looming. In May, Prince Harry, that's William's younger brother and one of the most popular members of the House of Windsor, he's marrying American model and actress Meghan Markle. A feeding frenzy is underway. Media and merchandisers have been scrambling to cater for the event. The couple will wed in St George's Chapel in Windsor Castle, west of central London. The bells of St George's will chime to mark the happy occasion, but as Stephen Beard reports from Windsor, the cash tills are already ringing.
In their scarlet tunics and bearskin hats, the Coldstream Guards march down the hill alongside Windsor Castle, their black boots and brass trombones gleaming in the sunshine. But don't be fooled by the pomp and pageantry, this is business.
That's what the fabric of the town is. Business revolves around the royal family and the royal positioning in town. It all revolves around that.
Deputy leader of the local council, Phil Bicknell, says tourism is by far the town's biggest industry. Thanks to the royals, 7 million visitors flock to Windsor every year. An extra 100,000 are expected on the wedding day. And with dollar signs in his eyes, Bicknell anticipates a big influx of free spenders from the US.
The Americans are very keen that they're going to get into the royal family at last. They must be over the moon that at last they're going to get some American blood into the royal family.
Of course, another American divorcee, Mrs. Simpson, stormed the ramparts of the British monarchy 80 years ago. But since that ended in an abdication, no one in Windsor wants to dwell on it today. They're too busy making money.
And I will give you your change. Your receipt and your change.
Here in the King and Queen gift shop at the foot of Castle Hill, Harry and Meghan memorabilia have been flying off the shelves. Fridge magnets, T-shirts, tea towels and mugs bearing images of the happy couple and costing $18 or more. Here I bumped into a British customer, Margaret Tyler, adding to her collection of royal souvenirs.
I've got about 10,000, but...
10,000?
In my house, yes, yes. I've got no room to move hardly. I've got a settee, a television, a little kitchen. I haven't got anything else.
You're a monarchist then?
Something like that, yeah. I'm so excited about the royal wedding. I can't wait.
And she'll be here again in Windsor on May the 19th, wearing her brand new Union Jack blazer, waving two large British flags and cheering on the royal couple.
We just want a glimpse of them, don't we? We just want to see them. And they look so happy. Harry looks ecstatic, doesn't he? And we all, when his mother died and he was a little boy walking behind her coffin and the letter on the coffin that said Mummy, we all sort of adopted him, didn't we?
Tapping into that huge popularity, the merchandise makers have been working overtime and mostly without royal approval. The wedding has triggered an avalanche of tasteless and totally inappropriate tat, including some truly bizarre items, like the Harry and Meghan breakfast cereal and the Crown Jewels condom. But bobbing on this tide of mostly forgettable memorabilia, there is one item that's attracted much attention, a plate bearing the image of Meghan and this well-known redhead.
She played the fiddle in an Irish band, but she fell in love with an Englishman. Kissed her on the neck and then I took her by the hands. A baby, I just wanna dance.
No, not Prince Harry. It's the slightly less popular English pop star Ed Sheeran. They got the wrong redhead. Lucy Bryant of Modern Chintz, who made the plate, says she made the mistake on purpose.
I wanted to have a plate that would just make people giggle if they got the joke.
Her inspiration was a mug commemorating the wedding of Prince William that bore a picture of Harry by mistake. Her joke is paying off. The plate is selling fast and at $35 a pop, even though this isn't quite in the spirit of a royal wedding.
Can we deduce from this plate, Lucy, that you're not a fan of the monarchy?
Well, yes, you can deduce that. I don't really feel that they have a place in our modern society.
You're not excited about the royal wedding, then?
The short answer is no.
But you are going to cash in on it.
I am. I am indeed. And that makes me very happy.
Her happiness might be rather short-lived if the royal legal crockery begins to fly. If, say, there are legal problems and a lawsuit over the use of Meghan's image. But Lucy Bryant is planning a preemptive peace offering to the couple, her plate as a wedding present. Stephen Beard, DW, Windsor.
And I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. You're tuned to Inside Europe. Although several cities have seen sharp falls in tourism following deadly terrorist attacks, the sleepy English city of Salisbury is attempting to repair its reputation for another reason. In March, former Russian spy Sergei Siprol and his daughter Yulia were found collapsed on a park bench. British police said they'd been exposed to a nerve agent. The intrigue may have brought the world's media to the historic city, but safety concerns forced many local and foreign visitors to give Salisbury a wide berth. But with an economy heavily reliant on tourism, residents and business owners are desperately hoping they can soon return to some semblance of normality, as Nick Martin found out on a recent visit.
The bells of Salisbury's 800-year-old cathedral chime for 11 o'clock on a misty April morning. Lying close to Stonehenge and home to several leading examples of early English architecture, the city is normally bustling with tourists. But Salisbury's repute was suddenly called into question when the Russian spy poisoning case unfolded nearly 2 months ago. Many locals struggled to believe that retired Kremlin intelligence officer Sergei Skripal and daughter Yulia could come to such harm here, while long-time resident Alex Whitty was shocked at the subsequent diplomatic fallout.
Salisbury, to put it in context, is such a small place, and we actually call it Smallsbury as locals because nothing ever happens here. We've got Stonehenge nearby, we've got a nice cathedral, so tourism's always been quite high, but for something like this to happen is pretty extreme.
A few minutes away from the cathedral, Lydia Williams runs an independent coffee shop close to where the double agent and his daughter were found dying. Like the cathedral, which saw a 25% drop in visitor numbers in March, Williams saw her takings drop by up to £2,000 or $2,800 per day.
I notice an incline in trade because I'm so close to the scene of the crime, etc. Regulars are still, and tourism has dropped significantly in Salisbury, so have seen it affect me in the last few weeks massively.
She, along with other entrepreneurs, have appeared in the national media to insist that the city is still safe to visit.
I think people need to not be scared to come in because everything else is still open. There's just a few cordons you have to go round.
But concerns remain about whether the nerve agent Novichok, which was used in the poisoning, is still present in pockets of Salisbury. The crime scenes remain off-limits, while those who visited the ZZ restaurant, where the pair dined before they collapsed, were told to thoroughly wash the clothes they wore on the day of the poisoning. Investigators have identified 9 hotspots that could still contain traces of the potentially life-threatening toxin. And from time to time, people in military-grade protective gear can be seen working at the sites.
You can't get lost. It's a very small place.
Okay, great. Andy Maul, who opened a boutique wine and cheese bar in the town last December, says it has been a struggle to cope with the subsequent fall in visitors. But he says the morbid fascination surrounding the case hasn't kept everyone away.
It has attracted new tourism based upon wanting to see the bench where it happened, want to see the ZZs, want to see the mill, the places where international news and local news has been covering for the last month. But when it comes to people that may be slightly worried about coming out, it has really hit them because they just worried that if the gentleman and the daughter in question get better, are they going to come back to do more?
By they, he means those sent by Moscow, which has been widely accused of being behind the plot, despite its strong denials. With police and the army still at the scene, for Witty, it seems like an eternity waiting for life to return to the way it was.
And who knows? I mean, events can snowball quickly. Who knows what happens from this? And we could be talking about it in history books for years, but often these events, something else comes up in the news and then it's forgotten about. So hopefully it will go back to normal, but it'll always be the place where this happens. So.
Williams, meanwhile, hopes to receive some sort of rebate in her business taxes from a compensation scheme set up by the government.
I'm currently in the process of looking into getting some help with business rates, mainly because my business rates are quite high due to my location. My location is then tarnished. That's how I think I'm justified to get some relief. So reduced or scrapped business rates for a period of time whilst the investigation is ongoing, that would help businesses massively, especially small and independent ones like myself.
Yulia Skripal was released from hospital after recovering from her ordeal, but hospital authorities said at the beginning of April that her father remained quite ill. While British intelligence officials prepare to help him to go into hiding once he recovers, Salisbury residents and businesses prayed that everyone else would come out of theirs. Nick Martin, DW, Salisbury, England.
Hi.
Hiya.
What can I get from you?
Can I have a small black Americano?
This is Inside Europe. NATO foreign ministers have been meeting in Brussels to discuss increasingly bitter relations with Russia. Those tensions have led the United States to move back into an airbase in the far north that it left more than a decade ago. Terry Schultz reports from Iceland.
Staffed by some 3,000 American military personnel at its height, Keflavik Air Base was once a key military outpost for NATO, deemed critical for keeping an eye on the Russians. But after 5 decades there, in 2006, the U.S. seemed to believe the Cold War was permanently thawed, and it handed the airbase back to Iceland. Fast forward to 2014, Russia annexes Crimea. At the same time, surveillance flights in the high north notice a spike in the number of Russian submarines trolling the deep seas around Iceland. Washington knocks on Keflavik's door once more. Captain Jon Gudnason, commander of the Keflavik airbase for the last 30 years, recalls the brief phone call he got from U.S. officials in May 2014.
This started with 24-hour notice in 2014.
Literally 24-hour?
Yeah. Can we come tomorrow?
And you said, gee, it'd be great to see you, but why the rush?
No, we don't ask questions like that. We are used to things like that. This is what we are here for.
Iceland's foreign minister, Gudlaugur Thor Thordarson, answers the unasked question.
We all know why this is happening. It's because that we have seen the activities from the Russian military, which we haven't seen for a long time, but this is all started, you could say, after Ukraine.
Thordarson explains that in 2014, the U.S. used the Icelandic base for submarine surveillance for 20 days. In 2017, it operated there 150 days. The increased presence was formalized in a bilateral agreement in 2016, and the U.S. Congress has now allocated $14.4 million to upgrade the hangar for the P-8, a bigger and heavier aircraft than the P-3s that were used in decades past, and to install a washing rack to deal with the salt and sand that are Icelandic specialties. The foreign minister says the renewed presence signals a greater geostrategic interest in the entire High North.
You will see NATO as an organization is looking more into the North Atlantic than it's done for a very long time.
Captain Gudnason, who's a civilian, by the way, since Iceland has no military, says he's not worried these developments mean that Iceland will suddenly be stuck in the middle of a military standoff between the U.S. and NATO on one side and Russia on the other.
I think we are in no bigger danger. This is not a question about dangers or a dangerous situation at all, I think. This is a question about situational awareness and about knowing what the neighbor is doing.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg confirms NATO's tracking the spike in Arctic traffic, the highest number of submarines since the end of the Cold War.
Yes, we have seen increased Russian presence. We have seen more naval presence, more submarines, more exercises. But at the same time, I think it's important that we try to keep the tensions low in the High North. It's in our interest and in Russia's interest. But the message is the same, that we have to be firm, we have to be capable of delivering credible deterrence, and therefore NATO also need more, for instance, naval capabilities.
NATO Deputy Spokesman Piers Cazalet explained further that Russian submarines could pose a challenge to NATO's freedom to operate at sea, undermining the alliance's ability to move reinforcements between North America and Europe in a crisis. Threats like this are one reason NATO is creating a new Atlantic Command to ensure smooth coordination. There's also concern that critical deep-sea communication cables there could be compromised or sabotaged. Cazalet says rebuilding anti-submarine capabilities is one of NATO's top priorities. Magnus Nordenman, director of the Atlantic Council's Transatlantic Security Initiative, has been intensely studying this situation for a book he's writing on the role of the North Atlantic in the new European security environment. And Nordenman is deeply concerned about developments in the deep seas.
The Russian Navy of today is not the Soviet Navy. It is far smaller, has far fewer ships and submarines and so on. On the other hand, it is far more sophisticated and far more skilled than it was during the Cold War, and it has added new capabilities, including launching cruise missiles, which they have shown repeatedly off the coast of Syria.
Nordenman notes this is a capability only the U.S. and U.K. used to possess.
This is now very much a Russian capability. So one of my key concerns with the resurgent Russian submarine force is their ability to launch long-range cruise missiles against targets in Northern Europe.
Longtime Icelandic anti-military activist and repeat presidential contender Thor Magnusson is worried for other reasons. He fears this U.S. presence at Keflavik is a harbinger of military escalation with Russia. Magnusson, who founded the humanitarian organization Peace 2000, believes his fellow Icelanders feel the same way. He accuses the Icelandic government of hiding plans for a buildup.
Public opinion is absolutely against this. The Icelandic public do not want a military in Iceland. And if they knew what the true plans of the Americans are, they would absolutely be disgusted.
There's been very little controversy about the American activity in Iceland so far, and the government has emphasized the base will not be rebuilt to Cold War levels. Foreign Minister Thordarson underscores that everyone hoped things wouldn't ever go in this direction again. The new Prime Minister of Iceland, Katrin Jakobsdóttir, has actually campaigned to quit NATO. But Thordarson says that's not in the cards for now.
In the perfect world, then you wouldn't need to have any military activities, but we are not there yet.
Terry Schultz, DW, Reykjavik.
If you'd like to contact the show, we would love to hear from you. Our email address is europe@dw.com. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. In the next half an hour, a special report from Poland, where many women are fighting government attempts to restrict access to abortion. And we travel to Chernobyl, Ukraine, in the former Soviet Union, 32 years after the biggest nuclear accident in history. Stay tuned for these stories and more. First, here's Guy Hedgeco in Madrid, where the regional government has been rocked by a scandal involving face cream.
Yes, Keith. Madrid's regional president, Cristina Cifuentes, has resigned after a video emerged apparently showing her being caught shoplifting in a supermarket. The video, which was published online by a newspaper, dates back to 2011. It shows Cifuentes being escorted into a room by a supermarket security guard, who then asks her to show him two pots of face cream, which she had put in her bag without paying for them. Cifuentes obeys and eventually does pay for the items. Shortly after the video went viral across Spain on Wednesday, Cifuentes announced she was stepping down. This is the second scandal to engulf her in recent weeks. In March, a newspaper accused her of obtaining a master's degree from a public university without doing the coursework or attending classes. Many had tipped Cifuentes to one day succeed Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy as leader of the Conservative Popular Party. But as she announced her resignation, Cifuentes hinted that individuals within her own party had been involved in leaking the incriminating video footage. For DW, I'm Guy Hedgeco in Madrid.
Women across Poland have been protesting government attempts to further restrict access to abortion. Since the end of communism, the predominantly Roman Catholic country has had one of the most restrictive abortion laws in Europe. The ruling Law and Justice Party wants to limit abortion even further, something that many Polish women are fiercely resisting. All across the country, they've been taking to the streets to raise their voices. Here's Sue Cox with a documentary compiled by Jan Palokat.
As the sun sets in Warsaw, a group of women spontaneously gathers in front of the Parliament building, along with some men. Hanba, shame, they shout.
Proszę państwa, lista hańby.
Marek Biernacki! Marek Biernacki! Marek Biernacki!
The list of shame proclaimed here on a cold January night contains unfamiliar names. This time, it isn't representatives of PIS, the National Conservative Ruling Party, a natural enemy of left-wing women's groups, but rather members of the liberal opposition are also being criticised.
Trzy razy, drodzy państwo.
Joanna Fabisiak! Joanna Fabisiak!
Name after name is being called.
Oddaj mandat! Przeproś Polki!
So what happened?
Pamiętajcie, brak edukacji, zakaz antykoncepcji i przymus rodzenia to wasza...
A few hours earlier, Barbara Nowacka, a leader of the extra-parliamentary left in Poland, talked to the plenary hall. Her group, Save the Women, collected 400,000 signatures, calling on the government to liberalise the restrictive Polish abortion law, demanding women should be able to decide for themselves if they wanted to have an abortion. Poland currently has some of the most restrictive abortion laws in Europe, with terminations only permitted in exceptional cases. And the Conservative PIS party wants to restrict abortions even further.
Every year, over 10,000 underage girls give birth in Poland. But how many more opt for an illegal abortion? And how many people grow up in fear and humiliation?
A so-called citizens' law that was proposed to liberalise abortion in the country did not make it to the vote in Parliament. It didn't even make it to the stage of being debated in Parliament. In this case, many MPs of the ruling Conservative PIS party voted to discuss it in Parliament. But surprisingly, many members of the Liberal opposition did not even show up for the decision or voted against putting it on the agenda, going against the rule to toe the party line. Katarzyna Lubnauer, party leader of Nowoczesna, the Moderns, is not happy that the law to liberalise abortions did not even get discussed in Parliament, but tries to explain.
Our party is still fairly new, and many of our MEPs weren't aware that this was a vote on whether the proposed law should be discussed, not on the law itself.
Fellow party member Joanna Scheuring-Wiegus, a pro-choice supporter, was appalled.
I am a member of the modern party, not some medieval party.
It was a debacle for the already severely damaged political opposition in Poland. But the women's protests that continue across the country are a sign that outside Parliament, women in Poland are a power to be reckoned with. Anyone who messes with the women loses the elections, demonstrators chant. They also chant, "We are the opposition." Women's power is a fairly new force in Polish politics. It's unpredictable, noisy, and takes to the streets very quickly. The PIS party has also realised this power. In the autumn of 2015, the first attempts to tighten the abortion law disappeared from the political agenda after women took to the streets across Poland. The pro-choice demonstrators wear black as a sign of mourning for their reproductive rights. The women's movement has been popping up again and again, recently under the slogan Strajk Kobiet, Women's Strike.
We have no fixed structure, no fixed address, and no elected members of a supervisory board. We are all leaders.
Says Elżbieta Podleszna from Warsaw, who participates in the women's strike. I first met her in front of the police headquarters in the city centre in November. Along with a dozen other protesters, Podleszna blocked the right-wing March of Independence on a bridge which caused a row. Police later investigated.
We get in touch with each other through social media and the internet. There are also some men that join us. They understand that every totalitarian system begins with the restriction of women's rights, then moves on to impact other parts of society as well. We talk about women's rights in the context of human rights. It's a good indication of what's going on in a society, how society talks about women, how it looks at them, and how violence is used against them.
Grassroots actions such as the women's strike are in many ways countermodels to the ruling Conservatives. The party makes a show of putting women in the front ranks, like former head of government Beata Szydło. But at its core, PIS is a cadre party, led by a man, a patriarch, who still runs everything from the background. It's tightly organised, based on loyalty, and anyone who contradicts the leader is out.
All of us who are part of the strike, we share the conviction that it is important to move forward and to raise our voices. Sexist thinking says that a woman should be quiet and that we're not entitled to raise our voices.
Says Marta Lempert, a building contractor from Wrocław. She is considered to be the initiator of the strike movement. She put forward the idea of a nationwide strike against a further tightening of the abortion law on social media and hit a nerve. The idea spread throughout Poland. And then, one Monday at 4 p.m., women across Poland organised strikes.
To organizowali ludzie normalnie w miastach, nie żadne partie ani żadni politycy. No i tyle, no 150 miast.
It was people on the ground who organized this, not political parties or politicians. The protests happened in 150 cities across Poland and 60 more abroad. There is no organization behind it. I asked online who wants to participate and I wrote a 12-point guide for how to register a demonstration. So women from the small towns in particular did not feel alone. They were able to download the full range of posters and placards. Everyone had a chance to contribute. Those who couldn't join a march could at least get dressed in black. The reaction of business owners was also surprising. No one complained, and there was even a fan page for entrepreneurs who supported the women's strike.
The way this new women's movement expresses itself fascinates a veteran of the struggle for women's rights, sociologist Małgorzata Foszczara, former Minister of Equality in her country.
Back in the 80s, I was naive enough to think that equality is such an integral part of society that it would be impossible to restrict women's rights. And why would you even do that?
The problem today, however, is that gender equality was officially postulated by communist rulers. And more than two decades after the end of the communist system in Poland, the PiS government has now declared war on communism posthumously. They argue that the decades of the communist rule and the People's Republic of Poland were imposed on the Polish people by Moscow. So they want to eliminate the legacy of communism in Poland. That includes changing street names, history books, and people's memories.
Oczywiście, że taka figura feministki jest dyskredytowana w Polsce. U nas myśmy mieli
the image of feminists in Poland is being discredited as well. Right after the end of communism, the idea of equality was declared communist. They said, let's stop talking about equality, because that was the idea of certain people like Rosa Luxemburg. And all that ought to be buried. It was very difficult to overcome the idea that we owe equal rights to communism. In this respect, the EU and EU regulations have helped a lot. When Poland joined the EU, all of a sudden, everyone claimed that we had always been in favor of gender equality, ever since women got the vote in
1918.
As a result, the alienation of Poland from the EU will also impact gender equality and women's rights. But the country's national conservative leadership is by no means sidelining all women's issues. Law tightening is intended to deter domestic violence and rapists, and there are plans to punish men who don't pay alimonies more severely in the future. The PiS party is also aiming at an ideological change when it comes to women's issues. Left-wing women's groups and women's shelters receive less money, while conservative NGOs are being granted more funds.
Przedziurkuj i dopnij do tego.
Dobra.
Tak. Mhm. Pod spód, nie? To przedziurku.
Okej, okay, tylko chyba możesz podpisać, masz, nie?
Tak, to ja jeszcze podpiszę, ja jeszcze zrobię list przewodni, ja to wsadzę i będzie...
Zielona Góra is a city in western Poland, close to the border with Germany. The counselling centre Baba has long been supporting women in need and it has always had a clear focus on women's rights. Anita Kochaska-Dziedzic, the head of Baba, explains...
We believe in feminism. We are outspoken about women's rights. So we are fairly radical feminists. And because of that, we are considered enemies of the current rulers.
Feminist-themed posters are on display on the walls of the Women's Center. American film star Grace Kelly in an embrace with Cary Grant, except that, unlike the film's original... He's the one who is looking up to her. Another collage shows a chicken that has just laid an egg, with the subline, whoever has the eggs has the power.
Around 80% of the people who come to us are women who have suffered domestic or sexual violence or have financial problems or don't get alimony payments after a divorce.
But for women in need, there is another alternative in the region. The Movement for Women's Issues and Family has just won a public tender. We help people, emphasizes the director, Luzina Hoffmann-Gijic, including women who have become victims of physical violence. But she says that there are also many cases of psychological violence, and many of the perpetrators are women, she emphasizes.
Our principle is to help the family. If there's a problem, we'll do everything we can to solve it. We house women and children in a mother's home, or we help financially. We help those most in need of help, and that's usually the children. They usually suffer the most when things are going badly in families.
Focusing on family protection. This approach is more akin to the family policy tastes of the current government than Barbara's feminist approach. However, even the more conservative movement, just like the feminist groups, primarily advise women.
W naszym statucie jest wspieranie kobiet, jako że spotykamy się z tym, że one są słabsze, tak?
Our statute says that we support women because they're weaker and are most at risk of violence. They're often weaker economically because many have to take care of children and often can't get paid work. That's why we mainly help women. And for women, the family is fundamental, and that's why we help families as well.
Hoffmann-Gijic has quite a lot in common with her colleague from the feminist Barbar Women's Centre. Both are big, resolute, eloquent women who have firm opinions. But while one stands for feminism, the other says...
I don't feel like a militant feminist, and I don't feel discriminated against, though discrimination might exist.
And then she adds,
kobiety z gruntu są silne, są kreatywne.
Women are strong. That's part of their nature. They're creative. They have brains that are constructed differently. They can adapt more easily. They're able to express emotions. They're undoubtedly a force. Whether they can also be a political force, that I don't know.
But isn't that fairly feminist?
No, nie.
Back in Warsaw, the March of Angry Women has moved on to the PIS party headquarters.
Wy, posłowie PiS, którzy słyszycie krzyk zygoty i widzicie ból embriona.
I am a woman. I am Polish. And this is what you're saying to me. If I'm pregnant unintentionally, I should have the baby. If I'm raped, I should have the baby. If I am seriously ill, I should have the baby. If I do not have the money to bring up children, I should have the baby.
For the time being, the government has postponed the tightening of the abortion legislation. But in practice, Polish women often cannot even have a pregnancy terminated in the few cases when it is legal under Polish law. For example, when the fetus has severe malformations. Many doctors are afraid. They don't want to be attacked, says Romuald Debski, chief gynaecologist at Warsaw's Bielanski Clinic, where many of the few legal abortions in Poland are carried out.
W większości szpitali tego się nie robi.
Most clinics do not carry out any abortions, and those who do risk people demonstrating in front of their building. And because there are so few clinics offering it, not all developmental damage can be diagnosed in time during the pregnancies. We don't have enough resources here in Poland, so 2 weeks ago I had to send a patient to Berlin in Germany.
The morning after pill is still available, but now women only receive it when a doctor prescribes it. At the same time, thousands of doctors have signed the so-called conscience clause, which allows them to refuse to prescribe birth control. Pharmacists often refuse to dispense it. So, particularly in conservative regions, it's hard for Polish women to get contraceptives and take decisions about family planning and their own lives.
Forcing other people to follow certain religious principles contradicts my understanding of a secular and democratic state. For me, that is not a question of faith or conscience, but an individual decision. It's not the task of the state to teach morality,
says Barbara Nowacka. She is the daughter of a deceased, well-known left-wing politician, and some say she too has the making of a political leader. There is a lot of women's power and many strong women who are ready to take action in Poland. Women hold the potential for a serious counter-movement to the conservative Cultural Revolution of the PiS party. However, the new women's movement lacks a political party representing them in Parliament. But that's currently not the aim of Poland's women's activists. Recently, left-wing groups, not just women, met for a summit in Warsaw to discuss how to react in a country that keeps moving to the political right. The discussion was organised by Barbara Nowacka, and she stated,
"We're not going to start a political party today because it's not the time. We will not prepare lists with names, and today we will not name the enemy. We will only talk about what is important to us. Someday we will have to be in parliament, but to make it there, you have to acquire credibility and make concrete suggestions first."
That's Barbara Nowacka there, a leader of the extra-parliamentary left in Poland, ending that documentary by our Warsaw correspondent, Jan Palukat. Sue Cox presented the report. I'm Keith Walker in Bonn. Coming up, a report from Chernobyl, Ukraine, in the former Soviet Union, 32 years after the biggest nuclear accident in history. You're listening to Inside Europe. You're tuned to Inside Europe. When reactor 4 of the Chernobyl nuclear power station exploded 32 years ago, no one could have predicted the extent of the fallout. It remains the single biggest nuclear accident in history. 31 people died of radiation poisoning in the immediate aftermath. More than 250,000 people were evacuated from their homes in the months that followed the tragedy. A 30-kilometre exclusion zone around the power plant became somewhat of a barren, so-called dead zone. My colleague Nick Connolly went to see how nature is adapting to this unique habitat left behind by mankind.
The skylarks are singing their hearts out as we cross a meadow surrounded on all sides by dense forest. Every now and then, we come across ruined farm buildings. We're looking out for one of Chernobyl's most charismatic inhabitants, the wild Przewalski's horse, a heavy-built species that lives in big family groups. In theory, they should be easy to spot, but not today. Our guide, biologist Serhii Paskiewicz, gets out his phone, hoping for some reception. Motion-triggered photo traps dotted around the exclusion zone help to keep track of wildlife movements. Just a few kilometres from where we're standing, his cameras pick up a wolf ambling past, apparently in no hurry. Outside the reserve, wolves spend most of the day in hiding. Here in Chernobyl, there are now very few humans to avoid. The wolf population here is now thought to be 7 times higher than before the catastrophe, but still, no sign of the horses. Serhii takes us to an abandoned barn. The ground has been dug up and the floor is littered with what looks like blonde hair.
That's from the horses' manes. They come in here to scratch themselves. They love to get a rub along the walls.
But that's not all they're looking for in here.
They smashed the wood barrels that were here and ate what was inside, as well as the earth floor underneath. That's how badly they needed the salt they could find here.
No one showed these horses how to do this. In the space of just a few decades, they've learned to make the most of the human-made landscape of abandoned villages, just as they've adapted to Chernobyl's forests, which are also nothing like their original habitat, the steppes of Central Asia. Worldwide, fewer than 2,000 Przewalski's horses remain. All belong to populations that have been semi-captive at some point. The Chernobyl herd now numbers over 100. Scientists brought them here in the 1990s, in the hope that they would keep the grass down and prevent wildfires from threatening what remains of the reactor. And while they've singularly failed with that task, their adaptation to Chernobyl offers biologists a rare opportunity to study behavioural evolution in action. It's time to check the radiation levels. After all, we're only 20 kilometres from the reactor.
The background radiation here is the same as in Kiev, where we are now. The radiation has migrated into deeper levels of the soil, but that reading doesn't mean it's safe here.
It's one thing visiting for a few hours, but how has the radiation affected the horses? Their diet consists of vegetation that grows on contaminated soils. Serhii has spent the past 20 years studying the effect of radiation as it passes through the ecosystem.
Of course, radiation builds up in the horses, but it's not fatal. Their internal cell processes are very strong. The amount of radiation these horses are exposed to isn't enough to affect their health or reproduction. At least I haven't seen any anomalies, any two-headed horses.
It's a conclusion shared by most international scientists. But what about his own health?
So far, everything's been fine.
We get a call from one of Seri's colleagues. A family group has just been spotted grazing next to the main road leading to the power station. We jump into the car. And sure enough, there they are, no more than 100 metres from the road, under the gaze of an enthusiastic group of tourists. Some of the approximately 1,000 visitors who come to the Chernobyl zone every day. It seems they were hiding in plain sight all along. The male stands aside, watching us closely, while the females and last year's foals graze seemingly oblivious, their blonde manes flapping in the wind. They look very well fed. Serhii tells us that this year's foals have just been born in recent weeks, but for now, their mothers will be keeping a low profile in the forest. Since they were first introduced, the Chernobyl population of Przewalski's horses has already tripled in size. A group has even found its way across the border into the Belarusian part of the exclusion zone.
This is a very aggressive species. They can stand up for themselves. Wolves won't be able to catch a healthy horse. They're fast and they can defend themselves.
But what exactly will limit their further expansion? Will it be a lack of suitable habitat or competition between family groups? That's the subject of Serhii's next study. For now, faintly exasperated by our camera team, the herd trots off towards the forest. The forest that keeps on growing and in just a few years will surely swallow up this meadow. Nick Connolly, DW Kiev.
And that's it for today. The programme is produced with help from Sarah Stefan. The sound technician is Jürgen Kuhn, and I'm Keith Walker. Thank you for listening. You can get in touch with the team. Our email address is europe@dw.com. And also subscribe to our podcast on SoundCloud and iTunes. Inside Europe comes to you from Germany's international broadcaster, DW in Bonn.